11. Buried. The latter stages of my conversations with Mr. McAfee were far less satisfactory than the early talks. It wasn't that he was getting bored. I don't think his reticence was related to our project at all. I just suspect, rightly or wrongly, that whatever net he always knew was out there with his name on it was starting to close in by the summer of 2020. To that extent, it was no coincidence that our business relationship started getting strained. It was, after all, around this time that he first raised the insistence that he must only be paid in cryptocurrency. Previously, any minor disagreements he and I had regarding content, who to pitch the book to, whether coronavirus was real, etc., were resolved amicably and quickly forgotten. But the cryptocurrency payment insistence just wouldn't go away. In fact, the harder I pushed to resolve the matter or to look for viable alternatives, alternatives that would have been perfectly reasonable to anyone else I'd ever worked with, the more McAfee became angry and a little unpleasant. There was a time when I might have taken this kind of reaction personally. Sometimes these things are personal. However, what I had to keep reminding myself was that, for all our conversations, all our pleasant message exchanges, and all his off-the-wall Twitter posts, his situation, in hiding, presumably somewhere in Europe, wasn't as pleasant a situation as mine was in my home. As much as we bonded, our lives were undeniably different and would never be the same. I started using his wife Janice as a means to indirectly encourage him to carry on, and, if possible, to reconsider the payment possibilities in the spirit of keeping the book alive. She tried. Janice always tries. But the decision as to how our project would ultimately be conceived was always in his hands. Me, what did you think you were going back to as you sat on the plane? John McAfee. I had my clothes and about $5 in cash. Everything else had been taken from me when I left jail, which struck me as odd given that, apparently, I could have done anything I wanted when I was actually in jail. Nevertheless, I knew what I was going back to. America. Put me in America and I'll always know what I'm doing. It will always be my home. Good God, I functioned well in a third world dictatorship that was at war with me, so I had no worries about functioning at home. I arrived in Miami with basically no money. The story of my arrival was bizarre. The plane didn't even go to the gate. It just sat there while emergency vehicles started driving along the runway. I thought, fuck me, what have I done to fall foul of Homeland Security now? I had no idea what I'd done. We had serious officers coming up the stairs of the plane. Then the captain said, "Will Mr. McAfee please step forward?" I raised my hand, got up, and started walking to the front while judging the faces ahead of me to figure out who was in charge. I identified a well-fed, nice-looking fella, and I walked straight up to him and said, "What have I done now, sir?" "Nothing at all," he replied. "But the Northwest Terminal, where you were supposed to arrive, has 2,000 news people there. We fear for your safety. We will be taking you to any place that you would like. And welcome home, sir." Me. How do you even begin to start again after 5 years away? John McAfee. I asked for them to take me to the nearest taxi stand. "Yes, sir," I was told by the officer without any hesitation. They drove me there, and it was then that I realized they'd vacated an entire terminal at Miami International Airport. All there was at the end was a single yellow cab with a turban-wearing driver with both hands on the wheel, looking around and obviously wondering what the fuck was going on. I got in the cab, told the driver to take me to South Beach, and thus began a new chapter in my life. At one point, the cab driver turned to me and said, "Who are you, sir?" I looked back, thought for a second, and said, "I'm not sure anymore, but I don't have any money. If you take me to South Beach and are prepared to wait, I'll get you some." When we got to this hotel, where everybody knew me and knew I was coming back, I got quite a reception. I know you might think I'm exaggerating this, but I had been top world news for over a month. To this extent, I knew I could count on the concierge for getting a room for a few nights without paying anything until I found my feet. I also got him to pay the taxi driver, who probably changed jobs or maybe even religion with the tip I gave him on top of the fare. Me. Janice is such a vital part of your life nowadays. Tell me how you two got together. John McAfee. First, I contacted a guy called Francois Garcia from Venezuela, a promoter kind of dude. He had contacted me while I was in jail in Guatemala and persuaded me to start a website, to which I gave him certain rights to content, etc. I had his phone number, called him from the hotel and said, "I need some money. Can you help?" "Sure, wait there." 20 minutes later, this fat guy appeared with a paper bag. He sat down next to me and said, "You John McAfee?" "Yes, sir." He put the bag on the seat and just walked out of the hotel. There were $5,000, all of it in $5 bills. Janice will confirm that, later that night, when I decided to go out for a decent cup of coffee and met at my favorite place called the News Cafe, that all I had was $5 bills. On my way to the cafe, I had seen Janice and another white girl, both clearly hookers, walking towards me. I didn't pay much attention, but as Janice passed me, I did notice what I considered to be a 10 out of 10 ass on her. I'm an ass man, that's a fact. Me: "Did she notice you looking?" John McAfee: "As I turned, she turned too. She later told me that when she saw me first, her initial thought was, 'Nah, that guy has no money.' She wasn't far wrong. Anyway, I sat at the cafe and was enjoying my coffee when Janice appeared at my table. What she had done was gone past the hotel and chatted with the security guys, as she often did. One had said to her, 'Do you know who that man was that you passed earlier?' 'John McAfee.' 'I've never heard of him,' Janice replied. When he explained, Janice had come hot-footing it back to find me. Here she was at my table. Me: "Were you seeking female companionship?" John McAfee: "For once in my life, no. I just wanted a good cup of coffee and a good night's sleep in an air-conditioned hotel room with a soft feather mattress." Nevertheless, the first thing that came out of Janice's mouth was, "Would you like your dick sucked?" "I'm sorry, no. I do not want my dick sucked." "Can I have a cigarette then?" I lit her a cigarette, and she and her friend sat down beside me. "Are you girls out looking for old men to drug and roll? Because if you are, I'm not into that tonight," I told them. "Oh, we wouldn't bother using drugs," she said, which I thought was a particularly smart comeback. After a couple of hours of talking, I leaned over and said, "Can you get rid of your friend?" Her friend evaporated, and as she did, I realized that I really did like this woman. We spent the night together. We didn't have sex. I didn't want sex. I'd had enough sex. Even in a Guatemalan prison, where you can actually get some pretty nice chicks because all the pimps are incarcerated. Now I just wanted someone to cuddle and to cuddle me. We've been together ever since, even though during that night while I slept she was trying to figure out how to open the closet door, which creaked, so that she could steal my wallet. In the end she didn't, and I'm glad. It would have ruined everything for me. Me: "How did your relationship progress from there?" John McAfee: "There's something important I never told you. I have never told anyone this, and you'll know why when I do. When I was still with Jennifer, way back in 2005, when we were driving around the Southwest in my Hummer looking for potential airstrip sites, I was also burying stashes of valuable items and cash in various locations. We buried items in places where nobody would ever find them. Unless you had GPS, you could never find the places. Over a period of a few months, I stashed away over $1 million of valuable items. Watches, gold, cash, all for a later occasion when I desperately needed it. I'd just lost everything, and I mean everything. Cars, money, my houses, etc. I owned nothing in the US other than an emergency stash of money that I'd started when I founded McAfee in 1987. That was where I got the money to pay Telesforo Guerra. So when Janice and I first took a road trip in a car that I bought with cash, it was a long, circuitous trip across the country, and the reason it was that I was stopping periodically to retrieve these buried items. Janice kept asking me, "Why are we doing this?" Only later did I tell her, and I didn't tell her the full story because I never completely trusted her. Me: "You didn't trust the woman who is now your wife?" John McAfee: "Yes, she's my wife. We actually got married twice. I'm not certain that the first time counted, but we are married. But," and this is where my story gets difficult to believe, "Janice, for the first couple of years of our relationship, while we were living in a house in Portland and later Tennessee, was conspiring against me in conjunction with other people." Me: "Who was she working with?" John McAfee: "Initially her pimp, who she was still in love with, even though she was married to me. She was still seeing him, meeting with him in various hairdressers for black women, and strategizing with him by passing information to him about her location. He, in turn, was working with people who had connections with the Belizean government, Between them, they were trying to find a way to get me to return to Belize and get paid for it. Me, this is mind-boggling. Did she ever actually harm you? John McAfee. Several times. That's why, even now, when she brings me a cup of coffee, I always get her to drink some first. I'm in love with her, have lived with her for 8 years, but I can't fully trust her. As I've told you, I trust nobody, not even myself. The first time she tried to poison me was back in 2013. She wasn't trying to kill me. The poison was only intended to incapacitate me to the extent that I could be collected. But in the end, she couldn't go through with it. At some other point, she hid her pimp and his gang in our attic in Tennessee. I came into the house and felt that something was wrong. In America, I carry a gun at all times, bedroom, bathroom, and the shower. I went into the bedroom and I heard shuffling in the attic. Sometimes raccoons got in the attic, but this sounded bigger than a raccoon. So I just pulled my gun and went bam, bam, bam through the ceiling. Security is worth more to me than the integrity of any house. Suddenly there was a stampede, and the next day her pimp called her and said, "Get them guns away from that fucker." It was only a year later that she told me that it was her pimp who was in our attic. It was for reasons like that that I always have a gun on my person at all times. Me? Why were you living in Tennessee at all? That was where John, my head of security, was at the time. He later turned on me and almost had me collected in Las Vegas, but that's a story we'll come back to later. Me? Why were you with her when she was trying to sabotage you? John McAfee. What I saw in Janice, and still see in her, was a kind of salvation for me. I made my life about saving her. I know you can't truly save anyone in this world, but I wanted to use the rest of my life to keep a door open for her that could be walked through into another world, should the one she was in become unpalatable. Me? Did that become some sort of purpose for you, the Messiah complex again? John McAfee. Yes, as much as I did love her, and still do, it gave me something to do with my life. In some ways, I felt sorry for her because she had 3 kids who'd been taken away by social services because she was a working girl who was living with her pimp. The kids, who were from 3 different fathers, were living with Janice's father in California. After our trip across the country, we ended up in California, whereupon I insisted she visit her kids. She didn't want to, but I persuaded her anyway, even though I wasn't allowed in the house and was viewed with total skepticism by her father and her sisters. Understandably so, I suppose. Me, where did you go after California? John McAfee, we made our way up to Portland, Oregon, because I wanted to see a friend, Chad Easley, who I'd met in Belize. Chad was a nice, quiet guy, a cartoonist, and he'd come down to Belize to work on a comic book about my life, but had ended up leaving, totally traumatized, having been thrust headfirst into my chaotic life. Me, what happened to him in Belize? Did anyone not leave that country traumatized? John McAfee. Chad was around when I was back in San Pedro, around the time when members of those 2 gangs I mentioned were threatening me. He was also there when I had the meeting with Eddie McCoy, the 2nd most dangerous man in Belize. Me. Eddie is interviewed in Nanette Burstein's film and seemed like a major component in all this, yet you have never once mentioned him until now. Why is that? The omission makes me very nervous, I've got to tell you. John McAfee. This is massively important. Remember, I told you I was left a threatening note? Well, I did hire Rodwell Richards to find out who sent it, even though he was also working for the other side by that time, as most people like him often did. We found out that it was the White Lobster Gang, and we managed to set up this meeting with 2 brothers, one of whom was gunned down a month after we met in Chetumal, in Mexico. Me? Do I need to know their names? John McAfee? Swan was their surname. So anyway, I was meeting with gang leaders who were after me, and my ace in the hole was always Rodwell Richards. I sat down with those boys, and Chad was there drawing cartoons in real time of all this random chaos that was unfolding. During this conversation, it transpired that Gaspar Vega, over in Orange Walk, was actually directing these Swan boys. They demanded the money. I refused. They said, "He'll send somebody else," to which I replied, "Then I'll deal with somebody else." They walked off. Meanwhile, Chad had drawn out this whole scene in cartoon form. Me? I need to know about Eddie McCoy. I feel like you're avoiding this. John McAfee. Eddie was the somebody else. I met him a few days later in the Sail Away Cafe that I'd bought Jennifer to run shortly after we moved down there. Eddie, as feared as he was a cripple. Years previously, he'd been captured by rival gang members who sliced all the muscles in one of his legs. Even then, that bastard somehow managed to learn how to walk again, to the point where you might not have noticed if you weren't watching closely enough. I found out about Eddie from someone, and they told me that he had taken an assignment to kill me. He had been paid $10,000 upfront to kill me, with another $10,000 payable when I was dead. Eddie's nickname was Mac-10, because his modus operandi of whacking someone was to take all of his gang, the Mac-10s, and drive slowly past a house, shooting until there was nothing left. Everybody inside died. Babies, grandmothers, everybody inside died. I called Rodwell Richards and said, "Eddie," and he said, "Yeah, you want me to take care of him?" Rodwell would have loved that assignment. Eddie was one of his major competitors. Eddie fascinated me. He made a lifetime business of whacking people, but that never happened, thankfully. But Eddie is still out there doing his thing. Nothing changes down in Belize. Me, did you ever pay Eddie to do anything? The film subtly led us to that implication. John McAfee? No. The only person I ever paid in Belize was Rodwell Richards, and that was to threaten the drug dealers in Carmelita. Even after I returned to the US and was travelling around, being chased across the US with Janice, I still spoke to Rodwell once a week. It was he who told me that people in Belize were trying to engage someone in the US to pick me up. "They're going to try to kidnap you," he told me. Me? Why did they want to kidnap you? John McAfee? Among other things, they accused me of stealing sensitive records from government computers. That wasn't true. Every bit and byte was still intact. I just had a copy of them all. There's a difference. They still had it, so did I. Me. We went in a circle there that I thought was leading somewhere. I still can't figure out if there was something I was meant to read into. In the meantime, what did you do when you got to Portland? John McAfee. We leased an apartment on 20th Street. We got a couple of dogs, furnished it. It was very nice for a while, almost idyllic. At this point, I think there was some willingness on Janice's part to leave her pimp and side with me. But equally, looking at it from her perspective, I was this old white man who was wanted for murder in Belize. Was my character any better than that of her pimps at that point? Arguably not. But when something starts to feel comfortable, that's when I get wary. Nothing in my life has been idyllic for more than a few days. It's as if the universe detects something that's comfortable and decides to throw some chaos into the mix. That's the law of the universe. I start seeing more things and I start hearing more weird things that just don't add up. Me? Such as? John McAfee. The news that got me really thinking was when I heard that the Belizean soccer team was going to be playing in a tournament in Portland. Now, as far as I knew, Belize didn't even have a fucking professional soccer team. Any team they had was made of regular people like the local fireman or schoolteacher. And now, all of a sudden, they were coming to Portland? I'm not fond of fucking coincidences, and this information only confirmed what I'd heard from both Rodwell and a contact, Baltazar Garcia, inside the US Embassy in Belize. I was on high fucking alert. And then I got a call from Baltazar saying, "It's happening tonight." Me. As in, the collection attempt was about to happen. John McAfee. Exactly. That night, Janice was looking out the bedroom window and I was watching out the side window. When we leased the apartment, we had specifically chosen a corner lot that would give us a variety of views around the surrounding area. Janice noticed that there was a man with a uniform on standing by a light pole. He looked like an electrical worker, but he was standing there with a flashlight, flashing this light on and off. In my experience, I knew he was signalling something to somebody else, probably to tell them we were in the building. I suddenly felt that we had to react and fast. Me? What did you do? John McAfee. At 1 in the morning, I saw motorcycles, a black SUV, and a garbage truck coming down the street. I ran to Janice. All I had on was a pair of pants. I grabbed her and ran down to the basement where the parking garage was. I wanted to hide in the dumpster. I always liked dumpsters because they were warm in cold weather. But Janice said, "I'm not getting in the dumpster." Instead, we climbed up and hid under the back of one of the cars in this multi-level parking area. Within 2 minutes of us getting situated, the motion-detected lights went off. Then I heard a doorknob being turned, and then the lights went on again. And they stayed on for a solid hour thereafter. All we heard was slow shuffling in the garage. Up above, we heard footsteps and people running up and down stairs. At 3:30 a.m. the garbage truck came in. It was not the garbage day. They dumped the dumpster and then just sat there. 10 minutes later, we heard somebody shout, "Fuck!" They thought we'd be in the garbage dumpster. Janice saved my life. Me, this is one of the most bizarre stories I have ever heard. Do you expect people to believe this? John McAfee. I don't care if people believe it or not. This is the life I have lived. Janice and I were in a constant state of alert and fear. For basically 4 years, we ran, while a cast of pursuers tried to track us down across America. They even tailed Janice's kids at one point, which was definitely a step too far. What happened after the Portland raid? John McAfee. We found out later that the whole complex had been sold 30 days prior to the attack, and that it had been sold to an Armenian man who is now in jail for all kinds of things. He had formerly been a client of Belize's Minister for National Security. He had been in Belize regularly to party. That was the connection. Me? Had he been contracted to collect you? John McAfee. Yes. He had been paid by the Belizean government to try to collect me, but people continually misjudged how easy it always was for me to just walk away and leave everything I owned behind. We had furniture and all kinds of belongings, but we took a suitcase and the dogs, got in the truck and left. We never went back to Portland or, in fact, the state of Oregon. We went on a run for almost a year thereafter. We were being continually chased. We never spent more than 2 nights in any town in America. We checked in late and left early. This was our life for a fucking year and more. Me. Who exactly was chasing you? John McAfee. We got chased into Arizona at one point because somebody shot at us on the highway with a high-powered rifle. We saw them in advance. As we were driving along the highway, we saw a Jeep parked in a field with a man lying over the hood. God damn, that looks like a sniper, I said as I tried to pass the tractor trailer in front of us. A shot was fired, and it hit the bumper of the tractor as I passed. The ricochet sounded like a flying saucer. We saw the metal flying. We got off the highway onto a back road. For an hour, we didn't see a single car coming the other way. Then we approached a single-lane bridge, beside which were parked 2 automobiles, each of them with 4 men inside. I slammed on the brakes, jumped out of the vehicle, and immediately looked behind me. I knew there'd be somebody coming. Nobody came from behind, so I basically barreled past the bridge while the vehicles moved aside to avoid a crash. They lost me. They always lost me. Me. Was this still the Armenians after you? John McAfee. Yes, and also another former client of Belize's Minister for National Security, a very successful American businessman who I really cannot name, had, I believe, also been contracted to hunt me down. Also, I heard that the Sinaloa cartel, given that it was also connected to the Belizean government, was another faction that was trying to collect me. At one point, they also had people watching Janice's kids. I had a friend in the cartel. Unfortunately, I can't name him either. I was speaking to him weekly. Sometimes I'd put him on speaker just to entertain Janice. Me. How did you come to know someone in the Sinaloa cartel? John McAfee. I got to know him via his son. I did business with the son, who was involved in a university in Mexico. I was helping them with cybersecurity. Anyway, when I found out that Janice's kids were being watched, I called this guy and said, "You have crossed the line. I have never harmed you and never spoke a bad word about you." John, he said, "Do not worry. It's not me who is after you, but I know who is. I am your friend. I will always be your friend. In fact, you should come back to Belize. I have lawyers who can fix all this." Well, I just laughed. "Good God," I said, "who do you think you're talking to?" But after the call, the tail on Janice's kids mysteriously disappeared. Me. Did you ever meet Janice's pimp in person? John McAfee. No, I only ever talked to him on the phone one time, and that was when we were in Portland in 2013, while she was initially trying to get away from him. Anyway, he called, and he and Janice were yelling at each other. "Give me the phone," I said to Janice. She handed me the phone with her pimp still on the other end. "This is John," I said. "You send Janice back now, or I'm going to send up a gang to cut you to pieces," he said. "Well, if you really want to do that, please inform everyone to bring their own body bag, because I'm sick of buying body bags." "Don't you get gangster with me," he said. "Please," I told him, "I'm not threatening anyone, but please just have some common courtesy." He hung up the phone. That's the only time I ever talked to him. I do not scare easily. Me. So did all this continue until you left the country in 2018? John McAfee. On and off, we had periods where things calmed down. The first year and a half was the worst. We even went to the FBI to report what was happening. They did nothing. We became reasonably friendly with an undercover cop who worked for the FBI in Colorado. His name doesn't matter, but he had some stories to tell himself. He had been physically threatened by members of an Islamic terrorist cell that the FBI had infiltrated down on the southern border somewhere. He told me that members of this cell pursued him when they realized that the FBI had discovered them. He also told me that somebody had tried to shoot him through his office window at some point. "Nobody believes what's happening to you," he told me, "but I do." My story was his story. Me, could you even trust the FBI at this point? John McAfee. We got to become reasonably good friends. He was a low-level agent, not a manager or anything. I went into his office one day and said, "I know for sure that someone will approach you one day asking if you'll whack me. How much is that going to be worth to you? $1 million? Two? 10? What if they kidnap your daughter and start sending her fingers to you in the mail or pictures of her minus an ear?" "I know what you're saying," he said, "but let me be frank with you. You always come into my office with a gun. So if I choose to shoot you in the head, the biggest problem I would have would be vacating the office for a couple of days while they cleaned your blood off the walls. Do you understand the power of this position?" In that moment, while I appreciated being told this information, I couldn't also help acknowledging the power that government agencies had. Basically, this guy was saying that he could shoot me, or perhaps anyone, at any time, with no consequences. It was so revealing. Anyway, when things cooled off a little, we went to live with my head security advisor near Lexington in Tennessee. Mike had worked for some serious mob bosses in Chicago and came highly recommended when I hired him to look after property of mine in Rodeo, New Mexico, a few years earlier. But when I left the US to go to Belize, he didn't go with me because I didn't think I'd need him. However, he remained very loyal in my absence, and I activated him again when I went on the run. It was he who got cash to me in Guatemala, for example. It made total sense that he should be my bodyguard now that we were back in the US. He was one of the few people I thought I could trust, and I used the word trust very loosely. At that point, I barely trusted myself. For about 6 months, Janice and I were not comfortable living anywhere other than in Mike's house. More of a nicely done double-wide on a huge piece of property, which was 3 hours from Memphis. He and his wife vacated their master bedroom and gave it to Janice and me. Because Mike didn't work for anyone other than me at the time, he was always home. They had two Mastiff guard dogs, and the property had expansive views across the surrounding countryside. If anyone came into the neighborhood, we'd know about it almost immediately. This was real rural country where they basically lived by their own set of rules. They still made white lightning moonshine in illegal stills. If a stranger crossed the blurred boundary that separated rural Tennessee from urban civilization appeared, someone would stop them and say, "Why are you here? Who are you looking for?" It was perfect for us. Other than for the first month when a few curious strangers passed through, we had no harassment. Me. What were you doing for money at that time? Did you work on any business ventures? John McAfee. Well, I didn't need to do much because we were living with Mike and his wife, eating their food and contributing to their basic expenses. I was working, but only to the point that I was accepting speaking engagements at conferences on the subject of cybersecurity. I was in great demand and could charge $25,000 or even $50,000 for each appearance. After a period of time, it becomes uncomfortable living with another couple, especially when you are John McAfee. So Janice and I bought our own house 50 miles from Mike's place in a small town called Lexington. We were close enough that Mike could come and sleep the occasional night as security. However, now that we were living in our own house, things changed, and that's when Janice's dynamic and her relationship with her pimp became a problem. There were various intrusions, including when Janice's pimp was in the attic. One of the houses we had to sell because it leaked so much on account of all the shotgun blasts I'd fired through the walls at people I thought were prowling around outside. I wasn't trying to kill anybody. I was just hoping that the blast would be close enough of a warning to any intruder that it would scare them off. Eventually, we had to stuff these holes with towels and clothing to keep the place watertight. None of that stuff bothered me, however. I only ever had one goal: staying alive. Me. Why did Mike not stop this if he was a security guard? John McAfee. Mike, sadly, turned on us in the end. Although he kept his financial problems a secret from me, he ended up having to file for bankruptcy and was so desperate for money that he accepted a bribe to not be at DEF CON in Vegas to protect me on one occasion when I was a guest speaker. As I said before, an attempt was made to pick me up. I evaded that attempt too. Me, at what point was Janice totally on your side? John McAfee, you're making some very broad assumptions, my friend. I'm not even sure she is now. Please, God. But seriously, I think she is now, but only because she has followed my ass for so long that she's now in more or less the same trouble as I'm in. They want to arrest Janice just because of her proximity to me. While Janice has serious street smarts, 10 years on the meanest streets of America as a prostitute will give you those, she has no experience in how to avoid the clenches of corruption in government and law enforcement agencies. For me, that's my fucking speciality. If I have to have a speciality at all, it's fucking with governments and law enforcement agencies and using my speed to simply sneak away or make myself invisible. Without me, life would be very difficult for Janice. So 75% of her is on my side, and right now, those are percentage odds I'll happily take. Me. For what reason did you leave Tennessee for North Carolina? John McAfee. Latterly, our house in Tennessee had been on a lake. Being on a lake is fine, but when you love boats like I do, you realize that a lake is just a fucking lake. After an hour, you've been everywhere. But the ocean, that's infinite. So we bought a house on the sound side of Hatteras Island, which is surrounded by some of the most interesting, roughest waters anywhere in the world. I then bought a small boat and also a larger boat, and thank God that I did. Me. Why was the grand jury convened in the first place? John McAfee. At the end of 2018, I heard about the convening from two separate sources, 2 weeks in advance of when it was meant to happen. On behalf of the IRS, myself, Janice, and four of our compatriots were being charged with unspecified tax fraud charges. Grand juries are only convened for felonies. Felonies mean serious jail time. However, I knew this was coming. I had not paid tax for 10 years. Me? Why not? John McAfee, I'd just had enough. I'd paid $50 million in income tax over the years. I thought that was plenty. I hadn't paid tax since I went to Belize, but technically, as an American citizen, even if you're not living in the country, using the services and driving on the roads, you still have to file and pay 30% of your income to the United States. The only two countries in the world that enforce that rule are the United States and Eritrea. How fucking bizarre is that? Anyway, I just said, I'm sorry, this is insane, I'm not doing this anymore. For a while, nothing happened. Me, what changed? John McAfee. In 2017, after my presidential run, I started going onto the international stage to talk about cryptocurrency. I was in Stockholm, London, Barcelona. I showed up wherever anyone would have me, and I said the same thing. Cryptocurrency can free us from the imprisonment that existing currency has put us in. What business is it of our governments to know what we earn? I also said many times. I then explained how the dollar and pound, etc. are controlled. The supply can be influenced, which in turn can devalue people's hard-earned money, and how everything is monitored through the central banks. I then explained how, in America, income tax is, in fact, unconstitutional anyway. It was only ever created to fund the war effort in 1913, but that edict, like many others, was never extinguished after the original need for it ceased to exist. Me, you were basically encouraging people not to pay taxes. John McAfee, I was telling people that I thought taxes were illegal, and if they also felt that they were illegal and or unjust, they should just stop paying too. Not just that, I was showing them how to do it without getting caught. Now that hit a nerve, as I knew it would. Here's the thing. I'm not here just to mouth off. No, I'm here to goad and to prod my enemy. I like doing that, just like the Apache Indians had something called counting coup, where they knew they could kill their enemy but preferred to poke them repeatedly and run away. Basically, I was annoying the shit out of my enemy, but all of this goading finally tipped the balance. Me. So did you get any warning that they were looking at you? John McAfee. I got fair warning because the IRS and SEC started subpoenaing records from companies that I worked for in the States. That was a sign that they were watching me. Most men in my situation would have simply shut the fuck up. Instead, I started talking louder. Grand juries are intentionally top secret so that people can't run. But I'm John McAfee. You can't keep a secret from me, especially if you're my government. I don't just listen to one source and take it as gospel, though. I got the information verified by another source, and based on that information, we knew we had until a certain date to leave the country. Me: if you hadn't fled, would someone have literally turned up at your door? John McAfee: absolutely. They would have swooped in and collected me in my home at 6 a.m, with particular emphasis on swoop. And I'd have probably been thrown in jail for the rest of my life. I wouldn't be able to talk to you. I wouldn't be able to talk to the press. I might be in hiding now, but I get more exposure than ever. Plus, I'm still prodding that hornet's nest as often as possible. Since I've been on the run, I have posted publicly on Twitter things like, the SEC is a festering pustule on the face of America. I don't know how you goad them any more blatantly than that. It's my job to do it because, more than anything, I want the government to show its true face. We can all put on a face, including our governments, but only when it's poked hard enough and it responds hard enough does it show the world what it really is. And that's what I'm trying to do with the US government. I want the world to see that what's happening to me could also be happening to them, and in 20 years' time could be happening to everybody if I don't at least continue my fight. Me: was there a specific reason you left America and sailed straight to the Bahamas? John McAfee: I went to the Bahamas simply because they had no income tax, and therefore I couldn't be extradited for a crime that doesn't exist in the country where I was residing or visiting. International law prevents that. I figured we'd stay 3 to 6 months, but we only lasted 3. Given there was no legal way to collect me in the Bahamas, I knew that they could only go down the illegal route. But the illegal route takes time, especially when you're dealing with me, the slipperiest motherfucker on the planet. I knew they couldn't slip up, couldn't get caught, and that it would take time to organize and plan any sort of collection. Sure enough, after 3 months, I started getting word that the CIA, on behalf of the State Department, on behalf of the FBI, on behalf of the IRS, was planning to do something. Me: how does this information get to you? John McAfee: keep in mind, when I started McAfee back in the 80s, my primary enemy was the hacking community. I admired most of them, truly I did. These were bright young kids, and later, when we got into the era of groups like Anonymous, some of these people even had a strong fucking message. Freedom. Privacy. Just give us fucking privacy. Over the years, especially after I left McAfee, I became something of a prime target. Just imagine how much of a badge of honor I hacked McAfee would have been for someone. So in turn, I got very adept at protecting myself, and in doing that, I realized that disinformation and deception are far more powerful than any barrier you can erect to try to stall your enemy, because, given the history of warfare, we know all too well every barrier is eventually overcome. Disinformation, on the other hand, though, that's powerful stuff. Making your enemy believe you're on the other side of the hill? Making the enemy believe that you're dead? Well, that's powerful shit. Me: are you a hero to the hacking community? John McAfee: over the years, I certainly became very friendly with the hacking community. In fact, I was invited to speak at DEF CON in Vegas in 2014. Incidentally, somebody tried to collect me that night because they knew I'd be there. But now, the hacking community are collectively my closest friends, to the extent that there is nothing involving my name that might impact me that does not reach me almost instantaneously. Bear in mind, there are hundreds of thousands of dedicated hackers in the world, and I doubt there is a single one who does not consider me to be their brother or their patriot, and in many cases, even their leader. For those of them that are reading this book, I hope this relationship continues because they have saved my life more times than I can count. Me: were Anonymous involved when you were on the run in Belize? John McAfee: they were, but that was an instance where the hacking community wasn't especially helpful, ironically. I had started my blog to tell my side of the story, while Anonymous, that loose group of who knows who, had shut down every internet department in Belize, as well as all communications to and from the country. I'm sure they probably thought they were helping me, but I was in hiding above the Chinese warehouse in Belize City and needed access to my blog in order to keep my story alive online. I ended up having to send someone into Guatemala to make a phone call to someone in Boston to say, please, God, stop. A few hours later, everything was restored. It's scary what power these hackers have, and they really are my ears to the ground nowadays. Me: is the information always reliable? John McAfee: generally it is, but any time I have a suspicion that something is off, I can put out a specific message that says, can someone please verify this specific area of interest? and I'll get hundreds of responses from which I can, by process of elimination, work out what is happening. Me. So it was the hacking community that tipped you off about the raid that was planned in the Bahamas? John McAfee. Yes, that's where the information came from, and I acted on it. Paul Roy, the police commissioner of the Bahamas, in conjunction with the long chain of command from the IRS, was trying to have me arrested as an undesirable. That way they wouldn't need to extradite me because there would be no law or court involved. Had their plan worked, I would simply have been expelled back to the US. That's how they wanted to bring me in, but they failed and I ended up embarrassing Paul Roy in the process by revealing sensitive and embarrassing information relating to payments he received from a CIA agent gone rogue. It was a parting shot from me as if to say, you motherfucker, you mess with me and I'll show you what I can do. The next day, as we were on the way to Cuba, a news story appeared in the Bahamas saying, Paul Roy sues John McAfee for defamation of character. Me? Why did you go to Cuba next? John McAfee. By this time, it was very clear to me that all bets were off in terms of the US ever attempting to collect me legally. The events in the Bahamas had illustrated that, by fair means or foul, they were determined to bring me in as soon as possible. I was embarrassing them. It couldn't continue. Meanwhile, they now knew I wasn't going to go anywhere where I could be picked up legally, so we arrived in Cuba. It was a strange country and very nice. After a month or so, Janice and I were called in and asked to turn up at a military installation, which in reality looked more like a Greyhound bus shelter. Nevertheless, we went in and sat down on easy chairs. We weren't prisoners in a cell, nor were we in a room with a friendly environment like an American boardroom. Someone said, the US government has unofficially asked us to return you to America in return for certain concessions. At that time, American warships were just off the coast of Cuba. We could see them. America did this from time to time as if to say to Cuba, listen, we can't touch you, but we are still the power, so you better toe the goddamn line. They then said they were disinclined to make us leave, but that it would assist them greatly if we left within 72 hours. Eventually, they would have had no option but to get rid of me. Me being harbored by Cuba, a communist dictatorship, was only going to heap further embarrassment on the US. As the day approached, the Cuban authorities called around regularly, saying, now, Mr. McAfee, you are sure you'll have left within 41 hours, yes? If I have to swim to Haiti, I'll be out of here, I told them. But again, I knew how serious all this was. If the US was actually appealing to Cuba, a country that it had beaten back into the Stone Age with sanctions over the years, well, that told its own story. But I didn't know how serious it all was until 4 days later at sea when we arrived in the Dominican Republic and saw military soldiers, not just the police, lining the dock. The rest, my friend, you know. Everything that I did in the Dominican Republic was focused on one thing, how to not get sent back to America. Me, are people from Belize trying to track you down as of right now in 2020? John McAfee, well, I have since lost my ears and eyes down there. I have had no information from anyone in Belize for a while. Baltazar Garcia doesn't answer his phone. The very thought of Rodwell Richards just scares me nowadays more than anything else. Any other friends I had down there, like Eddie Ancona, were leaned on. Others were imprisoned. Others were killed, I truly believe. There is just no recourse to law in a country like Belize. Me. So is it a case of out of sight, out of mind regarding Belize for you now? John McAfee. Yes, I haven't really said anything about Belize for a while, and I'd imagine they like that. Me. Are you taking drugs again now that you're in hiding? You mentioned that when you need them, you're going to take them. John McAfee. I don't really take the drugs that normal people take. Granted, I do a bit of cocaine, marijuana, and methamphetamine, but I'm much more interested in the Chinese chemical research industry. This isn't shit to kill plants. These are chemicals for modifying people's behavior. Why do the Chinese want to do that? Well, with 2 billion people, they've got more behavioral problems than anyone. And the research isn't just aimed at their population, it is also geared towards warfare. 20 years ago, I established relationships directly with some of these manufacturers, to the extent that whenever my name comes up in China, you wouldn't believe how much people like me. We were swamped when Janice and I went to talk at a conference in Beijing in 2016. I was bemused. I had no clue how anyone knew how the fuck I was. I got out of a taxi at the Great Wall and this guy ran up to me shouting, John McAfee, John McAfee. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, I digress. These Chinese chemicals have been an important part of my life because they are a very potent part of my life. So yes, I take them, and yes, they modify my behavior. You tell me how you'd like to feel or act, and I can come up with a concoction to make that happen. Me. I have to ask you something that you may not like. It has been suggested by many that you are just paranoid, that you have always been paranoid. I can see why. What do you say to that? John McAfee. I've heard that before, and it's just a preposterous suggestion. Indeed, if anyone is paying attention, pretty much everything I've ever been alarmed about, to the extent that I've felt the need to warn other people, has happened. People said I was exaggerating the need for internet security back in 1989. People said I was just being paranoid. Who was right? I've warned people about privacy and government intrusion for years. Who was right? I knew what was happening in Belize when the government was conspiring to frame me. Who was right? I'm not paranoid, my friend. I just happen, as I've told you several times, to have a good feel for impending doom. And if I can warn people when I sense something coming that could potentially affect us all, nobody can stop me from saying so. And as I've also said, I am now an old man who has to rely on my wife Janice to be my eyes and ears. I can't always trust my perception, mainly because I still think like a 30-year-old. I remember when I was at an event in London a few years ago. People were crowding around me. Young, insanely hot women still throw themselves at me. God knows why. In my mind, I think these women actually want me. At no point do I think, why would a 20-year-old goddess want anything to do with a 75-year-old man with bad knees? At no point do I think, this doesn't feel right. Who has sent you? However, Janice does. She knows every fucking move any woman on the planet can possibly pull. She just stands there observing. On that trip to London, this chick came up to me, put her room key in my hand, and whispered in my ear. Janice removed the key from my pocket, politely handed it back, and said, he won't be needing that. I'd been thinking with my ego, my dick. Janice was thinking, this girl might look like an angel, but really she's a she-devil with a fucking ice pick. To that extent, Janice and I are the perfect couple. We are truly in this together until the very end.